You're listening to the Monetary Blog from the FOMC Insight Engine. This is the supplement. Arthur Burns tells Los Angeles that his instruments cannot reach this inflation and names the ones that should stand beside them. On December 7, 1970, Arthur F. Burns returned to Los Angeles as chairman of the Federal Reserve Board of Governors, addressing the Pepperdine College Great Issues series before an audience at the Beverly Hilton Hotel that had come to hear the sitting chairman explain what was happening to prices. This was not a commentator's diagnosis. It was the operative framework of the institution that sets the policy. Burns spoke with the fluency of a man who had made this argument before and with the restraint of an official who understood how far a chairman could go in public. He reminded the room that he had stood in this same city once already. Nearly 3 years ago, in a talk here in Los Angeles, I pointed out that once an economy becomes engulfed by inflation, economic policymakers no longer have any good choices, he told the audience, returning to a warning he had delivered before the current inflation had fully declared itself. The claim was not new. What had changed was how much of it had since come true. He had come, in other words, to say something a chairman is not expected to say, that the tools available to him might not be equal to the task in front of him. This post belongs to a series that carries an open, falsifiable expectation on the record, whether a certified productivity crossover actually arrives on the schedule promised for it. This speech is a chairman certifying exactly such a crossover in real time, in public, while his own institution's internal files were being written alongside him. This post arms that expectation, and arms it with the earliest instance in the series of a crossover announced as a foundation by the man whose institution would have to live with it. What follows are testable claims, set down by the chairman himself, on the record of the institution he led. We went into the archives. The admission. That candor is not incidental, it is the mechanism. Once Burns reaches the substance of his address, it produces the sentence the entire investigation turns on. The chairman of the Federal Reserve tells the audience that the instruments he controls cannot reach the inflation the country actually has, and asks for something to be placed beside them. Here are his own words, at length, before anything is done to them. As Arthur F. Burns put it, in a society such as ours, which rightly values full employment, monetary and fiscal tools are inadequate for dealing with sources of price inflation such as are plaguing us now, that is, pressures on costs arising from excessive wage increases. Not imperfect, not slow, inadequate to a problem driven by costs rather than demand. A society committed to full employment, Burns argues, has ruled out the one response that would let those tools work on their own. Unemployment sustained long enough to break a wage-price spiral. That, on his account, is a limit, not a preference. He said as much elsewhere in the same appearance. What I see clearly is the need for our nation to recognize that we are dealing, practically speaking, with a new problem, namely, persistent inflation in the face of substantial unemployment, and that the classical remedies may not work well enough or fast enough in this case. More directly, monetary and fiscal policies can readily cope with inflation alone or with recession alone, but, within the limits of our national patience, they cannot by themselves now be counted on to restore full employment without at the same time releasing a new wave of inflation. The admission has a shape. Two tools, each competent against one problem alone, neither competent against both at once, and a clock, national patience, that will not wait. A chairman's public certainty is not evidence that the building agreed with him. A later chair recorded a unanimous hold over a committee that was split, the disagreement kept out of the public account, see the inference. The record the institution kept for itself does not contradict the pressure he describes. The following year, the Secretariat recorded internally what wages were doing to costs, even as the recession should have cooled them. As FOMC Secretariat put it, and yet, in the recent recession, compensation per man-hour, including fringes, has continued to rise at over a 7% rate, close to the increase at the cyclical peak. The picture isn't entirely bleak. Some easing of wage pressures has been evident. That is the institution talking to itself, describing the same cost pressure Burns named in Los Angeles. The archive supports the operative half of the claim. Within the limits of national patience, the instruments could not then be counted on to restore full employment without releasing a new wave of inflation, and the cost pressure behind that judgment was real. The record documents that half directly. The premise underneath the limit, each instrument competent against one ailment alone, is a proposition the record does not reach. The Post takes the limit claim as the record leaves it. Operative half documented, premise unaddressed. The premise is not neutral ground held in reserve. If it is real rather than convenient, then what Burns asks for next is a request the limit itself has made necessary. Whether the diagnosis underneath the limit will hold is the next thing the record has to answer. The diagnosis. The part of Burns's account easiest to check against what the board already knew is also the hardest to dislodge. That the inflation of December 1970 no longer ran on demand, but on the upward push of costs, wage rates chief among them, and that settlements struck under new collective bargaining contracts kept accelerating even as unemployment rose. Whether that diagnosis would hold was the question the admitted limit left open. Moreover, wage costs under new collective bargaining contracts have actually been accelerating despite the rise in unemployment, Burns told the Pepperdine audience, a claim the board's own record can be checked against, line by line. The staff had already logged the weaker half of that pairing. The Green Book, prepared weeks before the speech, recorded that non-farm payroll employment fell by 480,000 in October, reflecting a sharp decline in factory employment. The same report placed the unemployment rate at 5.6% at mid-month, up from 5.5% in September. Wages were not following either signal down. A governor of the board had reached the same conclusion months earlier, and in terms that isolated the mechanism rather than the symptom. Andrew Brimmer told an audience that post-war productivity for the private non-farm sector had risen close to 3% a year, and that hourly compensation was now rising far faster than that, leaving unit labour costs, in his words, moving at an extremely rapid rate. That establishes the channel Burns described. It does not settle where the impulse entering it came from. Burns reached past the Federal Reserve's own jurisdiction for a third check. As the experience of our neighbours to the north indicates, inflationary wage settlements may continue for extended periods, even in the face of rising unemployment, he said, pointing to Canada. The board's staff produced a figure of its own. As Federal Reserve staff put it, the average annual increase in base rates resulting from major wage settlements was around 9% during the first 9 months of 1970. 9% against rising unemployment. Staff, governor, and the foreign comparison converge on one reading, and a standing objection remains. Francis's monetarist view that inflation is caused by monetary excess and cost push is only short run. The archive's readings split the question. They support cost push as the description of what wages were doing to prices. The diagnosis holds as description, while crediting Francis's account of ultimate cause against the structural reading Burns built on. If the diagnosis holds, the limit Burns confessed to moments earlier in the same room was not a rhetorical retreat from a problem invented for the occasion. What the room still does not know is whether the rest of what it was told that afternoon, the good news he brought about costs and productivity, and then the institution's account of its own performance, holds up as well. The crossover.
Burns then turns to what has plainly gone right. Because of vigorous efforts to cut costs, he tells the room, the growth of productivity has resumed after 2 years of stagnation. The retrenchment underneath that resumption reaches further than the productivity line alone. He lists advertising budgets curtailed, product lines discontinued, and layers of executive overhead removed, while non-production employment in manufacturing was falling at a pace the post-war record has not seen before. Corporate finance, chastened by the market stress of 1969 and 1970, has turned from the debt-financed acquisitiveness of the previous decade toward balance sheet discipline. On that base, Burns tells the audience, a prolonged and stable prosperity can be constructed. That shift from debt-financed acquisitiveness to balance sheet discipline sits beyond this investigation's reach. The archive returns no verdict on Burns here, neither vindication nor conviction. The archive backs the accounting at the level of the two phenomena. Output per man-hour in the private non-farm economy resumed growth after ceasing altogether from the middle of 1968 through the first quarter of 1970, and non-production manufacturing employment began declining. The resumption happened. The employment decline happened. The two phenomena are established. The pace Burns puts on the resumption, a 4% annual rate in the second quarter of 1970 and at 5% in the third, stands on the chairman's own figures from that afternoon, uncontradicted by the staff data supplied. His claim that the decline in non-production employment is unparalleled in the post-war period is corroborated by the staff record, not merely unchallenged by it. What Burns does with the accounting is a separate claim, and a larger one. He tells the room that these same facts settle a question the institution has been fighting over for 2 years. As Arthur F. Burns put it, "In my judgment, these widespread changes in business and financial practices are evidence that genuine progress is being made in the long and arduous task of bringing inflationary forces under control." The record does not withhold support from the channel itself. Efficiency and cost-cutting reducing prices is a channel it supports. The prescription Burns built on it is what failed, with inflation still entrenched at high levels afterward. Burns had reached for the same conclusion before. In testimony before the Senate Banking Committee on July 23, 1970, he told Congress the tranquilization of inflationary pressures is within our grasp this year. In that same testimony, he called the reduced rise of unit labor costs a sign the elimination of excess demand is beginning to bear fruit. Three statements, two audiences, one author. A chairman repeating himself is not the archive confirming him. What the staff had told the committee on November 10th appears in none of the three. The Green Book tracked the wage settlements moving through the pipeline and reached a conclusion that runs against the afternoon's optimism. As Federal Reserve staff put it, these large deferred wage raises are laying the groundwork for continuing pressures on unit labor costs in unionized industries in 1971 and 1972, regardless of demand conditions. Genuine progress was the word given to the room. Continuing pressure, regardless of demand conditions, was the word withheld from it. A crossover in the data is not a verdict on the inflation it is offered to explain, and what the institution itself was doing behind that same podium while the crossover was being announced has not yet been tested. The middle course. Burns turns from diagnosis to performance and states his own conduct in his own terms. Money growth, he concedes, is high by historical standards and calls the clear duty of a central bank to accommodate a crisis met in a single weekend without resort to excessive monetary expansion, and a budget deficit, he says, cushions the slowdown without releasing a new inflationary wave. He told his audience that afternoon, as Arthur F. Burns put it, "Monetary policy this year has also demonstrated, I believe, that it could find a middle course between the policy of extreme restraint followed in 1969 and the policies of aggressive ease pursued in some earlier years." Growth of the money supply through early December, he acknowledges, averaged, rather high by historical standards, about a 5.5% annual rate. He treats the number not as a departure from the middle course, but as the answer to precautionary liquidity demand earlier in the year, and calls meeting it the central bank's clear duty. Duty is a value judgment the archive does not adjudicate. The operative claim beneath it fares differently. The record grants that the 5.5% rate answered precautionary liquidity demand and rebuilt liquidity without producing excess aggregate demand. When Penn Central filed for bankruptcy on a Sunday in June, the Federal Reserve advised larger banks that the discount window would cover firms unable to roll maturing commercial paper and suspended the interest rate ceiling on large certificates of deposit. The committee's own memorandum of discussion recorded what followed, both the discount window assurance and the ceiling suspension, as basically a healthy development. Credit rechanneled into the banking system, not new monetary excess. On the crisis met in a single weekend without resort to excessive monetary expansion, the committee's own memorandum concurs, though no adjudicated channel reaches the measure itself. The deficit is the harder case. The revenue shortfall behind the 1971 deficit supports the cushion he describes, and the series has read accommodation like this running on until the staff called inflationary psychology present. See the analogue. He goes further, crediting the fiscal stance itself with lowering excess demand and lifting real activity, and that step is where the record reads differently. Francis made the point to his own audience the following June. As Darrell R. Francis put it, by December 1968, however, it became widely recognized that the fiscal package had little, if any, restrictive impact, and that the monetary ease had further fanned the flames of inflation. Francis went further. Beyond a year, the net effect on the growth rates of spending, output, and prices is near zero. An unidentified member told the committee in November 1969 that fiscal restraint was rapidly disappearing if it had not already done so, and Hickman reported in April 1969 that the projected second quarter deficit had been revised from a $6.7 billion annual rate to $11.2 billion. On the 1971 deficit, the staff's reading agrees with him that it reflects a shortfall in receipts from the slowdown. The expansive shift the staff measured belongs instead to calendar 1972. The year Burns himself named in this same speech as the mounting threat to present fiscal policy. What fails is not that reading, but the step built on it, his crediting the fiscal stance with lowering excess demand and lifting real activity. What this audience heard about liquidity rebuilt and stresses relieved also leaves out what the internal record was tracking in the same weeks. Corporate cash flow under stress the public account never mentions, and banks rebuilding liquidity while screening loan applications with greater care. The lending channel the series found never reaching small business. See the game. The diagnosis still stands. The account of his own performance does not divide so cleanly. Part of it the record confirms. Part of it the record has not yet judged. Part of it the record answers differently than he does. What remains untested is not his conduct. It is the request he is about to make of the room. The request answered. Diagnosis is not a program. Having just told the room that his own instruments cannot reach the inflation, Burns turns to what might. As Arthur F. Burns put it, we might bring under an incomes policy also the establishment of a high-level price and wage review board, which, while lacking enforcement power, would have broad authority to investigate, advise, and recommend on price and wage changes.
Around that board he hung the rest of the list. Import quotas liberalized, antitrust enforcement pressed harder, federal training expanded where wages were climbing fastest, local productivity councils formed nationwide, computerized job banks built out, depreciation allowances liberalized, the Davis-Bacon Act suspended, the minimum wage modified for the young, national building codes written, and compulsory arbitration reserved for disputes where the public interest was directly engaged. The review board he put at the center of that list had no power to compel anyone, exactly as he described it, and the exception on the list is compulsory arbitration, which the record itself describes as binding, and an arbitral award sets the wage. Among its items, liberalized import quotas and more vigorous antitrust enforcement go untested rather than agreed, since no query in this investigation reaches either channel, and the record neither confirms nor convicts him there. He is asking the President and the Congress for tools to meet a cost-driven inflation beyond what monetary tools could reach. The same friction the series later saw from the other end in a chairman's weekly breakfasts with the Treasury Secretary. See the inference. The incomes policy, central to the request, separates into two readings once tested. In a Green Book dated September 15, 1971, the staff set down what it expected the freeze to deliver. Average wage rate increases will be kept to about 5% annual rate, and price increases to about 2-2.5%. By November, Burns said the freeze appeared to have effectively halted the spiral of prices and wages. It was adopted and found insufficient on the record's realized outcomes, and the shortening of the transition he asked for by name operated and left its target unmoved on the record's realized outcomes. The readings differ. Moving the price level for a season is not shortening the interval between suppressed demand and restored wage-price relations. By October 1974, the staff had stopped hedging. From the staff of the Federal Reserve, controls do not stop inflation. They did not do so the last time around, nor even in World War II, when prices increased despite severe rationing. Indeed, controls can make inflation worse. Burns reached the same conclusion himself in November 1973, 3 years after asking for the tool, telling colleagues that controls on wages and prices cannot be expected to yield the benefits they did in 1971 and 1972, when economic conditions were much different. The record fares no better. The template inverts. Where the series found a reformer prescribing new machinery for her own institution, Burns prescribes supplements to tools he already holds. See the game. In March 1971, Minneapolis reported construction people expected no effect on the rise in construction costs, and one director judged the move a weak-kneed back down. Wage settlements ran at least 10% a year against a 6% limit. The Davis-Bacon suspension operated and left its target unmoved on the record's realized outcomes. A Fed staff simulation found the depreciation incentive's price effect negligible, its price index staying near base level. Caldwell's Dallas businessman called it not economical, considering the substantial volume of unused capacity, the heavy cost of pollution controls, and the limited returns foreseen. The depreciation allowance was adopted and found insufficient on staff simulation, not on a measured outcome. In June 1972, Zeisel told the committee a decade of manpower training had accomplished relatively little toward a wage unemployment link. Federal training was adopted and found insufficient on the record's realized outcomes. Burns reached for the companion measure that December. As Arthur F. Burns put it, "We need also to reevaluate our extensive manpower training programs and the feeble effort to establish computerized job banks, for it is clear that our labor market policies have thus far failed to contribute sufficiently to the objective of expanding employment, and yet avoiding the inflationary effects that monetary and fiscal policies so often tend to generate."
The computerized job bank, a feeble effort in scattered urban centers, was adopted and found insufficient on the record's realized outcomes. Compulsory arbitration was adopted, and the record does not establish an outcome for it. Its own impact was never tested, apart from the controls suite it was folded into. Burns told the committee in April 1972 that comparing recent wage and price increases with the months before the freeze, one would find a little improvement, but only a little, and the differences were narrowing. Darrell Francis had dissented from this approach as early as March 1971. As Darrell R. Francis put it, "Finally, inflations are caused by monetary excesses. Consequently, a slower rate of money growth is the solution to the problem.
We had labor unions and collective bargaining covering a greater percentage of our labor force in the early 1950s, but still halted a major post-World War II inflation with a slower rate of money growth. But the reworking of labor market structure was adopted and found insufficient on the record's realized outcomes, a finding that rests less on Francis than on Burns's own words in November 1973. A chairman confirming himself is not the archive confirming him. A chairman conceding failure is different. The concession runs against his own case, and that is what lets it carry the verdict. The National Building Code, proposed in February 1970, was adopted, and the record does not establish an outcome for it. National codes were never implemented at a scale that could test them. And the Local Productivity Council was adopted and found insufficient on the record's realized outcomes, with an honest complication attached. A supported channel is not a vindicated prescription, and here it was the prescription that failed. Francis drew the same distinction in June 1972, arguing that price stability would be enhanced by focusing not on direct government intervention in the marketplace, but on prudent monetary and fiscal stabilization policies. The youth wage differential stands apart from all of it. It was asked for and refused, never tried. The record yields no effectiveness verdict on it. The board wanted it, and Bruce McClory argued for it publicly, calling a differentially lower minimum wage for the young in their own interests. The House wrote something narrower instead, limited to full-time students, and Congress never let the institution learn whether the broader version would have worked. His claim about the review board lands in between. On its design, the record matches him exactly. Broad authority to investigate, advise, and recommend. No power to compel anyone. But the mechanisms he leaned on to make that authority work land on mixed ground, and a few of his formulations that afternoon never reduce to a claim the record can test at all. They stand neither proven nor disproven. Of the instruments the record actually tested, every one that operated was judged by the institution's own voices, and none returned to confirm him. One was asked for and refused before it could be tried, and the record never even reached the import quota and antitrust channels. The problem he named that afternoon is still the reader's problem, and what the record tested against it has already been spent. What is left? Burns closes on a promise. The stage has been set for a recovery in production and employment, he tells the room. A recovery in which our needs for housing and public construction can be more fully met. 10 of the record's 11 channels were adopted. 8 came back judged, and not one of the 8 confirmed him. 2, the record could not sign either way. 1 was declined, untried. What remains is what the promise depends on. The promise depends on housing and public construction moving with the general recovery he describes. The record reads the channel the other way, but not by one mechanism common to both sectors. Housing is interest-sensitive and counter-cyclical, starved when credit tightens in a boom, and reviving only once the economy turns slack, rather than when it recovers. Most public construction is only mildly cyclical. Peter Wagner, the board's senior economist, wrote 2 years later that most such demand was little affected by cyclical considerations.
As Peter Wagner put it, demand for most of these services has been little affected by cyclical considerations. In fact, growth in the state and local government sector has contributed an important element of stability during recessive periods in the rest of the economy. Burns reported in February 1970, the availability of mortgage credit declined substantially despite massive funds poured into the mortgage market by FNMA and the Federal Home Loan Banks, and housing starts fell to an annual rate of 1.3 million by the fourth quarter, one-fifth below the year earlier level. A general recovery is not the mechanism that reaches either one. That leaves the people. Reductions in employment have occurred among all classes of workers, blue-collar, white-collar, and professional workers alike, Burns says, and he does not distance himself from what they carry. I fully understand the frustration of workers who have seen inflation erode the real value of past wage increases. They are the ones waiting on whichever instrument is left standing, and a later call to redeploy liquidity toward the people who needed it most found no trace of the pipe carrying it their way. See the game. The diagnosis stands. The instruments he asked for beside his own have already been spent everywhere the record reached them. Every one that operated came back judged insufficient or left its target unmoved. Another was refused before it could be tried, and the record never entered some of the channels on his list. What is left in the building is the instrument he told this room could not do the job alone. The question is not which doors stayed open, it is which were already shut before he reached the podium, and which he had decided not to open. Burns began that afternoon by returning to a warning he had delivered in the same city years earlier. An economy engulfed by inflation leaves the policymaker no good choices. The record assembled since confirms the first half of what he told the room. The inflation he was diagnosing had shifted, by his own admission and by the Federal Reserve's internal papers, from a problem of demand to a problem of cost, and the classical instruments at his disposal could not reach it without reopening the wound of unemployment. That limit was stated to an audience of strangers in terms his own staff would have recognized. What he asked for beyond that limit, instruments to stand beside his own, market-oriented and structural rather than monetary, was a request the institution's files had already priced, in language less generous than the one he used at the podium. The series opened with a question about a certified crossover and whether it would arrive on the schedule a chairman promised for it. This speech supplies an early instance of that promise, made in public, with the cost side of the ledger sitting in the same institution's papers in the same weeks. What remains open is not whether the crossover came. It is whether the limit Burns described that afternoon was the limit he found or the limit he chose, and whether a central bank asking the political branches for instruments beside its own is a sign of candor about what monetary policy cannot do, or a hand extended past where an independent institution's authority is supposed to end. This has been the Monetary Blog from the FOMC. Insight Engine at causalityineconomics.com.